At the outset on Tuesday, I acknowledged that this institution had blessed me beyond all other educative processes that I had touched. And let me say now, at the end of our time together, you have done it again. You have graced me far beyond my deserving by the gift of your ears, the gift of your serious regard for what I have done. You have affirmed me, you have challenged me, you have taught me and modified my consciousness. Dialogue took place yesterday in relation to what I said, and what something I didn't say was said to me that has meant a great deal. And I go away with a great sense of joy. Thomas Wolfe is right. You can't go home again, but periodically you can go through home again. You can go back to the sources that birthed you, shaped you, affirmed you. You can learn there gratitude and get a sense of hope for the future out of a memory of the goodness of the past. So I do thank you, each one, for your wonderful hospitality. Eloise and Frank Thomas have been wonderful hosts and hostess to us in the Faculty Center, and it has been an exceedingly joyful experience for me to be here. In all honesty, I have only one disappointment, and that is the weather. One of the things that I liked about Louisville was the variation of the seasons, and one of the things that I found difficult in Texas is that it's so monotonous. There's just about a season and a half there. It gets a little cool in the winter, stays hot like this the rest of the time, and I had really looked forward to coming up here and having my mind cleared by bracing cool, and lo and behold, Texas hot air has come with me. Having said that, though, I realize I'm registering my charge to people who are not responsible. I was lamenting one day at Broadway that the weather had interfered with the attendance at a special event that we were having, and I was complaining about it. And Dr. Paul Stevens, who's a member of that congregation, came up to me afterwards and said, "Listen, you've got to remember, as far as the universe is concerned, you're in sales, not management. You're going to have to leave the driving of the weather to somebody else." I heard once about a missionary that went to a primitive tribe and finally learned the language and found, to his dismay, that they had no word for the weather. And when he asked the chief why that was the case, he said, "Why talk about it? What can you do about the weather?" And I think there's a great wisdom in learning how to accept some of the cards that are dealt to us and to give our energies toward those things that we can change. The weather is not your fault. You too are in sales. And that's really a very, very minor disappointment. I have tried this week to come around the event of preaching from several different angles. So much has not been said that should have been said. You always will face that when you try to speak. You can't say everything. But I have attempted to show how preaching does relate to a minister's concept of himself or herself, how it needs to be freed by a functional sense of grace. I tried to talk about the form that authoritative preaching can assume. I tried to suggest that there are processes through which we move in the building of the word event that is called a sermon. And today I want to close by turning to the future and fantasizing with you about where it looks like to me we are headed, what the demands and challenges are going to be for the person who wants to participate in this awesome intersection of divinity and humanity that is called worship. The preaching of the Word of God can become the Word of God. That I really believe. But what is it going to be like as we live into and through the last third of the 20th century? It is obvious to you that the only thing that doesn't change is the fact of change itself. The church, like everything in history, is caught up in many subterranean tides of alteration and modification. So many things are happening to the church today. There are great, great things going on. Some of these are the growing sense of the laity as active participants in the process of church. There is a growing trans-denomination ecumenical spirit right after World War II. It took the shape of the conciliar movements. That's beginning to wane. But don't think for one minute that the mark of ecumenism is not on us forever. Things like Crusade for Campus Crusade, Young Life, Billy Graham Association, These are trans-denominational enterprises that involve the different parts of the body becoming aware of each other, interacting with each other. I think this is here to stay. The 60s gave the church a new sense of social consciousness that, though again it seems to be waning, I think is a permanent part of what we take with us into the rest of this century. And in the area of worship, it appears to me that there is a profound reformation going on. Men are beginning to feel differently about this thing called worship. And as I look back over the 20 years since I formally finished my theological training and began to practice ministry, I believe I have undergone more change in my concept at this point as to what worship is and to what my role in it should be of any area of church life. This week I have not hesitated to share with you how I have come to where I am. And so perhaps the way I can set in perspective how I see this modification occurring and what it says to the future is just to trace for you for a moment how I have changed in my perception of what worship preaching is and also about what my role is going to be. I was raised in a rather typical middle-class Southern Baptist church in Nashville, Tennessee, the Belmont Heights congregation. And as I look back on those early experiences of worship, I have two impressions. One is it was a spectator enterprise. Going to church meant sitting in a room that housed about 800 people and watching the choir and the man in the pulpit do certain things. To me, going to church was watching what Dr. Kelly White, who was the only pastor I knew until I was 18, and what the choir did. The other impression I have was that it was essentially a rational enterprise. Now, it wasn't intellectual. Don't get that confusion. But it was rational in the sense that the main medium were ideas and words. What we did essentially in church were to talk and to sing. The important faculties was one man speaking and everyone else listening, and the main enterprise was a rational exchange, mind to mind, ideas moving from person to person. Now, I admit, at Christmas time, people used to put on bathrobes and try to impersonate the shepherds and the wise men, but that was the closest thing to drama, that is, something that was actually happening that I ever saw in my local church. And I would never have thought of calling the Lord's Supper a celebration. It was always tacked on at the end of the service. My childish memories are that whenever I saw that table up there, I said, uh-oh, we're going to be late for lunch today, because it seemed like that the service was its regular length, and then that got tacked on at the end. What I'm saying is that there was no sense that objects can also convey the mystery of God's grace and love. I would have to say that my earliest experiences of worship was that it was a kind of formalized informality. It was formalized in the sense that it was utterly predictable. We did the same thing every Sunday in the same sequence. We would come out, everybody would be talking, the song leader would try to cry out over the din to give us the first number, everybody would stand and sing, we would have a prayer, then we'd have two other fast-paced hymns, then there would be a long time of announcements, another prayer, another hymn, the offering, a solo or an anthem, the sermon, and the invitational hymn. This was not done with any originality or with any great intensity, but you could set your watch by it. You knew exactly when things were coming, and in that sense, it was formalized, but it was also rather carelessly done as I look back. I didn't get the feeling that there was any particular coherence, any reason why this or that happened in a certain sequence. It was a place where we went, we watched people do things, we did sing hymns ourselves, words, ideas were the main media, and it was a very predictable ritual. And it was to that kind of process that I gave myself when I decided to be a minister. If I sound overly critical of what has taken place, let me acknowledge that that process, with all of its limitations, did have a profound effect upon my personality. There was a warmth in that church. Significant adult people took an interest in me that had a great deal of impact on my finally coming to esteem myself. And there was, in the midst of all this formalized informality, some powerful communication of the sacred, of the holy. I came to have a real sense of awe before this mystery that we call God. And therefore, this process that I have described perhaps too lightly did have enough impact on me that when it came to the crucial time of deciding what I wanted to do with my life, I chose to pick up that tool, and that was really all that I knew about preaching and worship at that point. I had shared with you earlier the intellectual encounter that came to me when finally it was given me to believe that to the mystery of Godness, the man Jesus gives a face. That was a powerful breakthrough. And as I was trying to decide what I wanted to do with my life, at the time I was thinking about being a doctor. And I remember going home from college one summer to have just a checkup with the family doctor who had cared for all of my life. Incidentally, he was the grandson of Dr. J.R. Graves. His mother had been one of Dr. Graves' daughters. He himself was not a religious man, not a churchman at all. And I remember saying to Dr. Haley during that time, "Dr. Haley, I really think I want to be a doctor because I admire what you do. You help people so tangibly." Well, I remember he responded with a four-letter word that I will not use here and said, "What people really need is somebody to teach them how to live." He said, "I have a world of patients that I help them get back their health and they're still miserable." That was a very significant comment to me. It suddenly dawned on me that health is not the end of life, it is just a means. That you can be perfectly healthy and be utterly miserable. And his word, which was not at all intended to be life directional, "What people really need is somebody to teach them how to live," became a very crucial signpost. And as I looked around for the alternatives that would enable me to do that important task, it was the church that loomed highest on the horizon and became a part of my call, to which I later responded. So, for all of what I say about that process, it did at that time communicate itself to me as something infinitely worthwhile. The formalized informality was something that effectively touched my life. So when I became a pastor, this was the process that I inherited. To live in history is not to start at the beginning of anything. You always start in the middle of something. And so I finished college, came here to the seminary, subsequently was called to the Gilead Baptist Church down here on Poosie Ridge in Madison County, Kentucky. And I began to do worship in exactly the way that I had seen it done in my home church and in the other churches that I had been a part of in college. This meant that I didn't give any thought, preparation-wise, to anything except the sermon. Let me be perfectly honest, at the outset, I didn't give a great deal of thought to that. I was like most young beginning students. After six Sundays there, I had exhausted the heritage that I brought to that place. And from then on, it was from hand to mouth. I know what it is to have to say something and have nothing to say. And it was the kind of situation where if there had been a particularly fine sermon in chapel that week, things went better that weekend. I had gotten the inspiration. The pastor at Crescent Hill was not printing his sermons at that time, unfortunately. And I was living very much hand to mouth. Things that other people said that I thought were true quickly found their way from them through me to this little congregation. And I'm sure I wasn't different from a lot who are put under the pressure quickly of having to preach every week. My uncle, John Buchanan, was pastor out here at Finchville in Shelby County, which is one of the great seminary churches across the years. And he told me once that out of the lore of that church was the story that come the spring, a pastor graduated and the chairman of the deacons called the seminary and said, "Send us out four, we'll see how we like them, and then maybe we'll make a decision." And it so happened that right before that, a particularly stirring sermon had been preached in the seminary chapel on the eighth commandment, "Thou shalt not steal." And so the first man went out under the impact of this stimulus and gave his impressions of the eighth commandment. The second week, another man went up. He too had a very moving experience under that word. He shared his impressions of the eighth commandment. The third week, yet a third man, also under the influence of the power of that word, went out and shared a sermon on the Eighth Commandment with the Finchville Church, and according to my uncle, that afternoon, the chairman of the deacons called the president of the seminary and said, "What do you think we are out here, a bunch of thieves?" Said, "Everybody you send out here preaches on stealing." That's simply the way it was with me when I first started working with this process of worship. It never really occurred to me to give any thought to anything except the sermon. Gradually, as I began to get more experience, I did begin to pull more and more of myself into the sermon. But it never did occur, as I have indicated, that any other part of the service merited any kind of thought. In fact, we planned our liturgy, our order of worship at Gilead Church, after Sunday school was dismissed and before the service began. And I would meet with Mrs. Click there at the piano, and we would leaf through the hymn book, and we were limited not only by the Baptist hymnal, but by what she could play, which was only about a third of the hymn. And every once in a while, it would occur to me that a certain hymn related to what I was talking about, but never any thought of making a coherent whole of this experience. I did, at that first church, begin to find something else, though, about the impoverishness of this way of doing worship, because I began to realize that the prayers that I were offering Sunday by Sunday came straight off the surface of that moment, that here I was standing before these people and lifting them up to God week by week, and I was saying the same things in the same words, depending on what had happened most immediately. And I remember beginning to say, perhaps I ought to give some thought to the prayers that I lead for this congregation, as well as for the sermon. Maybe that was when I began to come of age liturgically, that I realized that there was something else to worship beside the sermon that merited preparation. Moving on from there, I gradually, slowly began to realize that the whole hour, the whole service, ought to have significance, not just the sermon. I owe a great debt to Arnold Epley, my colleague in music at Crescent Hill, for bringing to me the stimulus and the challenge to give thought and attention to everything that is done in the service. And so gradually across these years, what has happened is that my consciousness has been widened. From thinking of worship solely in terms of the sermon, I have now come to realize that the hour is dedicated to an engagement with God, that there is more to worship than just preaching, that there is here many things that ought to be happening between God and the people and between the people and God. There is praise, there is thanksgiving, there is confession, there is intercession, there is proclamation, there is giving, there is decision. In other words, there are many offices to this great and awesome process of God meeting man and man meeting God, and that really and truly my task is not just to give a well-prepared interpretive word at the time of the sermon, but that my task is much wider, that I'm going to have to be what John Killinger calls the entrepreneur of a corporate worship experience. I'm going to have to see myself as one responsible not just for the sermon, but for the whole experience as the people of God gather to open themselves to the mystery and to receive His life into their lives. Now, I say to you that this is a momentous change of identity. This really makes my understanding of worship and my approach to worship leadership a very different thing than what it was when I set out in the ministry. In fact, I would say that there are several seminal assumptions here underneath this wider concept that I need to clarify, because they're the underpinnings of what I want to suggest for the future model. That is, that the minister in worship see himself as a liturgist as well as a preacher. I'm not saying that he give up the role of the preacher. I'm saying that he widen this to include attention and care and thought to the rest of the service as well. One of the things that has changed for me is the realization that worship is not a spectator activity, but it is deeply participatory if it is to be authentic. Now, I think one of the things that really helped me here was to come across the little analogy that Soren Kierkegaard gives in Purity of Heart, in which he contrasts the life in the Danish theater and what life in the true worshiping church ought to be. Undoubtedly, you're familiar with it. Kierkegaard identifies three components in the theater. There is the audience out there, the actors on the stage, and then there are the prompters behind the stage, those who make it possible, those who move the sets around, and when the actors lose their place, they say the words that enable the drama to get going again. Now, Kierkegaard says that the average worshiper may well think that worship is the same kind of arrangement as the theater. That is, the congregation is the audience, the clergy and the choir are the actors, and that God is the prompter. God talks to the minister during the week. He inspires him as the sermon and the service are given. But the real interaction is between the congregant as he's sitting out there, the clergy and choir as they're acting here, that this is the real engagement and that God is a kind of remote, offstage, during the week kind of participant. Kierkegaard said, this is not worship. Authentic worship comes when one realizes that the worshiper himself is the actor. That's where the crucial movements are taking place. God is the audience. Everything in worship is done before the mystery of holiness, and the clergy and the choir are prompters. That is, they are the ones who facilitate the interaction between the real actor and the real audience. All of the service needs to have an enabling, instigative function. The important transaction is not between the congregant and the clergy, but it's rather between the worshiper and the living God. And the service is here not to draw attention to itself, but rather to spark something that moves vertically back and forth between God and man and man and God. Now, once that got through to me, it changed my whole approach to how I did worship, to how I tried to plan worship. It is one thing to try to do something before people that they will praise, that they will think that this is good in itself. It is another thing to try to facilitate a group experience so that something happens between the people and God, and the service itself is the servant. Where the word service really comes from is the servant of that kind of interaction. Sometimes people will say to me, you know, you said something in the sermon that set me to thinking and I didn't hear anything else that you said. And I always say, then the service accomplished its real purpose. If we go to church and go out and all we have done is watch what the clergy and the choir have done, if our total reaction is to praise or blame the performance of the people up front, we have missed what worship is all about. Whereas if we go to a service and what is done there calls us into the process of interaction with God, some word of judgment, some word of hope, some word of light, some word that sets our spirit off into interaction with God, then the service has accomplished its purpose. So, one of the things that has happened to me is to realize that what I thought as a child, that going to church was to come into an auditorium, think about that, a place where you listen and watch people up front do things, that was the wrong concept. I have now come to see that worship is highly participatory. It fails if it doesn't get you into interaction with the Father who is seeking people to worship him in spirit and in truth. Another thing that has changed in my mind is the realization that worship, because it has to do with the Creator of all things, ought to catch up all of the powers of man, ought to use everything in creation. That is, it ought to be a holistic experience of bringing creation and Creator back into loving relationship with each other. Samuel Miller has said that man is the most permeable of all the creatures in the world. That is, we have more openings, more accesses by which the outside can get inside. We have more senses, more ways of participating in reality. And therefore, if we are the most permeable of all creatures, then we ought to learn to use all of the windows of sense in our interaction with God. And one of the things that I think is so emaciated in our Baptist approach to worship is that we have restricted it mainly to people talking to people. Ideas have been the main medium of interaction. We have lost the sense in which to do things with our bodies, to smell things with our noses, to taste things with our tongues, as well as to hear, ought to be a part of creation coming before its creator and being in living interaction. Now, there's a historical reason for why we as Baptists have such a limited approach to our understanding of worship. We grow out of the left wing of the Protestant Reformation, and it is always the case that when you take a corrective and establish that into a norm, you're going to get something just as distorted as that which you were trying to correct. Realize that the sacramental worship in the 15th, 16th century had become corrupt, compromised, mechanical, ritualistic, and the reformers found this so repulsive because it had become so meaningless, the sacramental drama called the Mass, that they said no to all of that. They threw away much of the pageantry, much of the incense, much of the drama of worship. All of that occurred at the dawning of the Enlightenment, when the mind was being rediscovered. It was at a time when the vernacular was becoming widely used, the Bible was translated, and therefore the fresh new force of religion was that of men speaking to other men out of the word that the laypersons could read. And worship ceased to be the using of all the senses to encounter the mystery of God, and it became the interaction of mind on mind, preaching, singing, talking to each other. It was a corrective that was very much needed. It did bring vitality and life and significance to the Christian faith. But in the process, we threw out a lot of the things that are still part of creation and still have great validity for worship. Therefore, what I'm suggesting is that we regather out of the heritage that our forefathers threw away a more holistic sense of what worship can be, and that we restore to our practice of worship not just the speaking of word. The speaking of word is always going to be important, but we need to recover some sense of the sacramental meaning of the universe. If everything was created by the word, as the book of Genesis tells us, that means that everything has the potential of speaking to us of God. Things can communicate the mystery as well as people. Now, I don't mean a kind of mechanical sacramentalism. I mean the attitude that is willing to hold up an object and realize that the Spirit of God can so illumine this that you can see through that object to the deeper spiritual realities that are being expressed through that word-created object. What I'm calling for is a return to celebration, a return to the sense that everything can speak to us of God if we will learn how to relate to it. And I'm calling for a kind of worship that is participatory, that learns how to use the body again, that learns how to use the senses, that learns how to taste, that learns how to touch, that learns how to get back in touch with all that is within us. And I think that if we can do this, that we can bring back a full-bodied vitality to worship. The youth of today and the Jesus Revolution are calling us back to this. In many ways, the Jesus Revolution is a reaction, I think, to overly rationalized worship. Worship that is too sedate, that utilizes too little of the human capacity. A worship that is more keyed to observing the Lord's Supper than celebrating the Lord's Supper. Observing is standing over against and just looking at something. Celebrating is plunging into the middle and is feeling with one's whole being this marvelous mystery of creativity. It is using all that is within us, as Psalm 103 says, to bless the Lord with all that is within me, bless his holy name. Therefore, it seems like to me that seeing worship as participatory, seeing it as holistic, is the direction in which we have to go. And added to this is the shape of the times in which we live. We cannot evade the fact that television has massively modified the consciousness of modern man, we now participate in life and truth differently than we did before the tube became so ubiquitous. Now, I don't begin to understand everything that Marshall McLuhan has said, but I do think he's right in saying that something profound happened to human consciousness when our electronic age was born. Now, I am very much still part of the Gutenberg era. That is, I'm used to getting my truth by reading it in a linear fashion, by standing over against something and thinking about it, rationally discourse. And yet, as I look at my son, whose life has been shaped by television all of his days, I realize that his way of getting truth is really different than mine. For example, I heard about the beginning of World War II, Pearl Harbor, about 24 hours after it happened over the radio, and I heard the next day by means of the Nashville Banner what had occurred over in Pearl Harbor. There was a detachment from the event. I heard about it, and later I read about it. When Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon, my son, like all of you, was present to that event with most of his senses. Television enables us to participate in life, not to stand over and observe it and to think about it and to hear it described in rational terms. And this has modified the way that the youth experience truth. They are used to being a part of events. They're used to using all of their senses. And if worship is going to be alive for the generation that has been birthed in the electronic era, it is going to have to be more than a person standing up and talking monologically. We're going to have to learn to use things. We're going to have to learn to facilitate group activity. Worship is going to have to become much more of an event, utilizing many, many more avenues of sense. And I think what is called for in the future, as I have indicated, is to move from seeing ourselves as preachers of sermons to understanding ourselves as entrepreneurs of a corporate worship experience. We're going to have to learn to be liturgists. Now, I realize that this falls very, very heavily on many of us. It represents a challenge for which we feel ill-equipped, for which we haven't had much preparation, and it may be something that there's a lot of resistance in us, given our Puritan background. It poses, in my judgment, one of the great challenges for the ministry today. Can we move to this larger concept of what we're doing? Can we develop skills that as yet are embryonic? Can we change our view of worship, therefore that we can lead people in this day to participate more vitally? It's going to mean that the minister himself is going to have to get a wider image of who he is. He's going to have to change his patterns of ego satisfaction. One of the things it means is that the minister is going to have to move out of the role of the star player and now become the player coach. I don't think the time is ever going to come that we will not need the professional clergy. That is, the ordained person who has the ultimate responsibility for seeing this process through. But I do think that we're going to have to learn not just to be the star performers ourselves. We're going to have to learn how to develop group experiences, train other people to do things. We're going to have to enable worship events rather than just perform the single role ourselves. And needless to say, that's quite a difference in the kind of satisfaction that you learn to expect. A star athlete gets one kind of affirmation because he does things well. A coach gets a very different kind of affirmation. He's not out on the floor, but his is the satisfaction that I made it possible. I convened the group. I trained them. I helped them put this together. And the victory, though it doesn't all come back to me, is nevertheless one that I participate in vitally. Now, I have really had to undergo a great shift here. It used to give me the greatest satisfaction to really put together a powerful sermon and have people say to me, that sermon was great. I'm now learning that there is a way to really get a sense of satisfaction out of enabling, making an event take place. And people don't ever come and say to me, you were great. They say, this was a great service. It's a different kind of satisfaction, but it's a very real one if we can learn to do it. I remember once when I was at Crescent Hill, we tried a different kind of communion service. We took a group of our young people and we developed a way for them to act out a kind of drama of inclusion as we were handing out the elements. It took a great deal of time to put this together, to plan it, to practice these things. It may well have been the most memorable communion service that we had when I was at that church. And yet I remember after it was over, nobody talked about the meditation, that is the sermon. They talked about this dramatic interaction that had taken place while the elements were distributed. And it took me a while to be just as pleased with having had a part in that as I would have had in having given a good sermon. We are going to have to learn to get our ego satisfaction from a different form of activity. It also is going to put a real challenge on the seminary. We're going to have to equip persons in the art of liturgics, which is not something that we have yet learned to do. And this is no one's fault. This is simply we're on the edge of a new kind of era. In my estimation, all of our seminaries still have departments of preaching where the emphasis is primarily on the sermon. And of course, this is the way our whole denomination is still structured. Have you ever noticed how the 8-point record system reads, attending preaching? It doesn't say participating in worship. It says attending preaching. Gilead, this little church that I first started out in, had a sign on the front for everybody to read. Gilead Baptist Church, founded 1842, and then preaching, P-R-E-A-C-H-I-N. They ran out of room, preaching every Sunday. That was the way the sign read. That is our heritage. Our heritage is that preaching, this rally approach to worship, you go, there are a few warm-ups, preliminaries, you get everybody in by the time the big speech comes, and then the word is laid on them. This is our whole tradition, and we're going to have to learn, in light of what worship is, in light of who we are with all of our capacities, and in the light of our psychedelic age, we're going to have to learn to do this for the future. It can be done. The challenge I have in closing is that to live in history is never to begin at the beginning of anything. It is always to inherit something out of the past, but it's never to participate in something that is utterly closed and ended either. To live in history is to live in the birthing of that which has not yet come to be, but exists in God's future out ahead. And it seems like to me that the great challenge of the preacher today is to learn to widen his perspective, develop skills that as yet we do not have, learn how to facilitate corporate experiences where through many different media, people are able to come in touch with the mystery of the love of God, where all of creation finally comes back into loving union with the loving Creator. It is an awesome challenge. It calls for many things that we don't at this moment have. But what's new about that kind of challenge to people who live with Yahweh, the God of the future, the God of promise? Perhaps Moses can be our model for negotiating this frontier. Moses was an old man in terms of years, and yet in terms of still having a sense for the not yet experienced, he was utterly alive. And one day as he was walking alone with his sheep, he saw something that he'd never seen before, a burning bush that was not being consumed. Most old people who feel that life has given them everything it has to give might well have said, there's nothing there, nothing new left under the sun for me. I've seen it all, I've done it all. And they would have walked on in the rut that they had developed. But Moses still had a capacity for wonder. He could still grow even though he was old in years. And so his curiosity about the not yet experienced drew him to this strange bush. And there, lo and behold, he encountered the God of his fathers. And at the end of two careers, lo and behold, he was given yet a third one. He was invited to do something he had never done before, to learn how to be a liberator and to go with God to free his people down in Egypt. Now, just like every one of us before the awesomely new He recalled and said, I am not equipped. The job is too big. It is too complex. I can't do it. In fact, he began to say, I know those guys down in Egypt. I went to prep school with them. The establishment is too tough to change. God, that can't be done. And I myself, I'm not eloquent. I don't have the skills that it calls for to do this new thing. And the God who calls kept saying, but I'll be with you. You have gifts, Moses, that you don't even realize. And what you don't already have, I will give you. Venture with me into the new, into this thing that you have never done before. And the great thing about Moses was that even as an old man, he still had the capacity to grow and to learn the new. He went with God. He found that all of his experience, surprisingly, had equipped him for this new task. He could do things that he had never done before out of the reservoir of what he had already done. His knowledge of the traditions of the Hebrew people, his insight into the establishment of Egypt made him a liberator. And after they had been taken out of Egypt and were wandering on the wastes of Sinai, his experience as a desert nomadic shepherd really came in good stead. He knew that territory. He was able to lead them. What I'm trying to say is that we know more about the future than we realize. We have more gifts than we might ever dream. It seems so new, but it's really simply taking what we've already been and utilizing it in yet growing fashion. Now, I think Moses, being willing to venture with the God of promise, he is our model as we move from seeing ourselves as preachers of sermons to entrepreneurs of worship, liturgists, those who take the whole hour, all of creation, all of human capacity, and find ways to relate these livingly and lovingly to the God who has made all things and loves everything that he has made. He will be with us in the venture. It will be exciting. Brave journey.